Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip. Jennifer St. George is senior lecturer in the College of Health, Medicine and Wellbeing at the University of Newcastle, Australia. She leads a research team on father-child play, with current research investigating father-child stimulating play, including rough and tumble, and its effects on children's social and emotional development. Jennifer is a member of the Australian Fatherhood Research Consortium and the 10 to Men Scientific Advisory Group. She has a particular interest in using observational and qualitative methodologies to explore behavioural and psychological aspects of child development and parenting. Peter Smith is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Goldsmith College, University of London. Peter has researched extensively in aspects of children's social development, has been awarded numerous awards for his work, and has authored, co-authored, co-edited 38 books, authored, co-authored 224 journal articles, 143 book chapters. He's also incredibly well known for many books on play, but also on bullying. And in fact, in recent months, we've interviewed one of your co-authors, who was Professor James O'Higgins Norman, because we know both of you have written extensively on the topic of bullying. So that fabulous book, The Psychology of School Bullying, is also something that we've talked a lot about within our podcast. So welcome to you both. How are you, Jennifer?
Thank you very much, Kathy. Lovely to speak to you and your listeners today.
And how are you, Peter?
Yes, I'm fine. Thank you. And looking forward to the podcast.
Well, I've been looking forward to this podcast for so long, because this is an area where I think a lot of both educators and parents have so much to learn. We think about rough and tumble play in kind of almost ambivalent ways as parents and even educators. In fact, what prompted this podcast was an educator noticing more rough and tumble play in that playground, particularly post-pandemic, when children had less experience of that kind of socialization, and wondering kind of how to handle it, because some children can find that jostling quite intimidating, whereas other children seem to sort of need it very much. So let's just talk about, from a psychological research perspective, what we mean when we talk about rough and tumble play, and what are the key characteristics of it that certainly distinguish it from fighting and aggression. So over to you, Jennifer.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy. And I'd like to invite Peter to start this conversation because we've had some good thinking about this together.
Okay, thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, well, rough and tumble play, it's play fighting or chasing. So it's behaviours like wrestling and grappling and tumbling around on the ground and chasing each other. And you might think it was actually aggressive, but there are a number of signs for rough and tumble play that is not. For example, the children will be laughing or smiling. They're happy to continue the game. They're not trying. No, it's not a case of one child trying to escape. Onlookers are not interested. If there's a fight in the playground, other children will gather around and watch. They want to see who wins. Rough and tumble play, no one's interested. It's going on all the time, actually. About 10% of the time in the playground, children are engaging in rough and tumble. And the children are friends afterwards, too. In other words, they don't separate with hostility. They just carry on being friends, perhaps doing something different after the play fighting is over. So all those characteristics, and children are very aware of it. We did a study some time ago with English children and Italian children as a cross-cultural comparison. And we asked them, what's the difference between play fighting and real fighting? And they came up with exactly those things. We're laughing and smiling, no one's watching us, and so on.
And of course, there's rough and tumble play between parent and child as well.
So it's not just in the playground. Tell us a little bit about that. Is that still characterized by those features?
That's back to Jennifer now.
Thank you, Peter and Kathy. Yes, rough and tumble play can, again, as Peter said, have the characteristics of less competition and more cooperation. So what we find in the parent-child space is that in the early days, whilst researchers and even perhaps family workers might call the play between child and father or child and parent rough and tumble play, but when the child is an infant, it looks more like dad or mum throwing the baby in the air or tickling or pulling their legs and so on. And that develops across time, and it really only when children get the mental development that in fact they can understand competition and cooperation that true rough and tumble play starts to occur with parents and children. And then, as Peter described, it looks pretty much the same. The big difference is that you can see more obviously that the parent clearly has to self-handicap. So the play is still mutual enjoyment. It's still physically engaged. It's still a little bit pushing the edges of comfort. But there's still the innate rules and unspoken most of the time, especially in the peer-peer play, that there's to be no harm. And in fact, that's one of the things that we do talk about with parent-child play is if the rules aren't obvious, then dad or mum needs to just say what those rules are. No biting, no hitting, and taking care of the environment itself. So, and it serves very much the same purpose of affiliation and creating good relationships between the players.
Every time we speak about this, I've got two boys and I remember countless events where there would be rough and tumble play, particularly with my husband. And then after about 5 minutes, somebody would be crying. So the boundaries, the rules, the emotional regulation required within this play is extraordinary. And it's something we're familiar with from looking at what's happening in the animal kingdom. Every single time we watch a nature program with David Attenborough, he always features animals playing together, which always makes us sort of chuckle and laugh. So we know that you've both recently published, I think it was 2022, fabulous, an article together, which has so much insights on rough and tumble play from other animals, which is so fascinating. So tell us about what that research showed and about the prevalence of this type of play across different species.
Okay, I'll take that one then. Yeah, rough and tumble play is very common in mammals, mammalian species. And a lot of work has been done on rats, actually, simply because psychologists love studying laboratory rats. But also been observational studies, for example, on primates, on chimpanzees and so on. Rough and tumble play is very common in the period from infancy up to sort of adolescence, up to sexual maturity. Then it seems to decline or change character. We can come to that later, actually. Rough and tumble play seems to change character in adolescence, both in animal species and in humans as well. But yeah, it's quite common. We see the same sort of characteristics that the animals seem to be enjoying it. There's the self-handicapping, which I forgot to mention, but Jennifer quite rightly brought that up. That's present in peer-peer rough and tumble play as well. So although there's hitting, perhaps it's not very strong, you know, it's mild kind of hitting, doesn't hurt you. There's also what's called role reversal. They might take it in turns for one to A to chase B and then B chases A, or A wrestles on top of B and then a bit later B wrestles on top of A. So they're self-handicapping and enjoying it and doing these role reversals. And that's true of rodent species, it's true of primates, it's true of humans. Just another thing is the gender difference. Males tend to do more of the play fighting, but there's not much of a gender difference in play chasing.
What is the function of it in those mammals? Like, why would they be play fighting together?
Yeah, well, the age distribution, the way that it falls off when you become sexually mature, and also the gender difference, it suggests that part of the function is practice for adult skills of perhaps hunting and fighting. And you're getting safe practice, basically, when you're a youngster in this. You're learning the skills, the movements. Also, you're learning how to regulate your behavior So whether you want to hurt the other one or not, normally, of course, in rough and tumble play, you're not wanting to hurt the other. So you're learning this kind of emotion regulation, which also seems to be true for humans too, whether we're talking about the parent-infant type of play or the peer-peer play.
Now, what about perceptions of R&T play, I think as it's called in the research, of this type of play? Traditionally, have over the centuries, have people been more tolerant of it, would you consider? Or how is it generally viewed by adults around children?
I think teachers tend to be ambivalent about it. Many teachers are women, teachers of early childhood, that is, and early to middle childhood, who perhaps haven't engaged in so much rough and tumble play themselves as youngsters. We just talked about that gender difference. And many of them tend to think it's, or confuse it with real fighting, or think that they may well hurt themselves. And you brought that up yourself, actually. The observational studies suggest that in peer-peer play, it's only a very small fraction of the play that actually goes too far. It can go too far, of course, but it's pretty uncommon. And given the benefits that we think there are for rough and tumble play, it'd be good if it can be permitted as much as reasonable. You mentioned some children, not liking it. I think certainly there should be quiet areas in a playground where, you don't have rough and tumble. And some children will prefer the quiet areas, as long as there's space for the children to run around and engage in it if they wish to. Jennifer might want to talk about the parents' view on this.
Yes, thank you, Peter. Again, a bit like educators, there are mixed views in terms of what parents think of rough and tumble play. Mainly, parents' biggest concern is when they don't understand the manifestation, if you like, or the purposes of rough and tumble play. Their biggest concern is, are they learning to be fighters? Are they learning to boss and dominate other people? And will they take that to the playground? So when we interviewed parents about that, about their children playing rough and tumble, most parents felt that it would normally be a good thing, and some parents felt this concern about how are they learning to regulate themselves if they're actually learning to fight. And so it's a very fine line, and as Peter said, what has to happen, particularly in the home, is for the parent to be sensitive to that child's needs. So if there's more than one child in the family, they're sure to have temperament differences, and they're going to respond differently, not just because they're a boy or girl, but they're going to respond differently to physical engagement. And so some might be more timid, some might be more extrovert. And so they'll respond differently, and they'll initiate play perhaps differently with their parents. In fact, some people talk about gentle and tumble in a way of still engaging in that physical play, but just with even more sensitivity in terms of the physicality of the play for some children.
And there is so much rich learning in looking at the interaction between different children as a parent. So you might be saying, now, look at your sister's face. She's not enjoying that, is she? Or I remember my own husband after a few minutes saying, I said no. No means no. Like, there's so many lessons about body boundaries and respect and, being articulate and having that social script for saying that I don't want to be part of that play anymore. So tell us more about that rich learning classroom that is within that play.
So within the parent-child relationship, there's the opportunity for the child, as Peter said, to learn emotion regulation. So to not get so excited that it becomes tears and screaming, to not get so excited that it becomes hard physical biting or wrestling. So, and then to be able to also become sort of resilient in terms of, well, Dad's beaten me twice now. He's got my sock off, or I've tumbled to the mattress twice and I haven't got him down yet. So there's that sense of building up the coping with, failure. There's also the sense of working in cooperation with another person. Now, Daniel Paquette is a very well-known researcher, Canadian researcher, who's done a lot of work in this area, particularly with humans and with some, and starting off with studying chimpanzees. And he very much talks about this balance between cooperation and competition. and that really characterizes this play. So that's what can happen in the parent-child relationship with the peer-to-peer, so the children inside the family. Again, that's where the parents need to be, first of all, the role models to show children how rough and tumble play works so that it is safe and so on, and the big one, self-handicap. And then to be, if you like, the moderator of any play that's happening in the home so that people learn how to play nicely, basically.
And in terms of the role of the parent, you've mentioned sort of tuning in or attunement and sensitivity, which a lot of parents may not be familiar with those concepts, but it's about reading your child, you know, being present in the moment, watching, observing. And if they are also playing with their siblings, there's an element of scaffolding and just sort of, you know, sitting back, stepping in. Tell us a little bit more about that kind of dance that the parent might optimally sort of engage in watching that play.
Well, I think, as you said, the attunement is the parent being aware of the child's emotional expressions and knowing what will work for that child. So then being able to step in and redirect or step in and finish the play, whether it's between themselves or between the siblings. And it's also about the parent being sensitive to the amount of challenge that a child needs. So sometimes in our observation studies we've done of dads and children playing rough and tumble, dad will simply whip off the sock off the child and say, well, there you are, I've got your sock, now what are you going to do about it? And sort of the child, there's no game that takes place. Other times, dads will sit back and let the children rip the sock off with no challenge from the dad to the child as to how hard is it to get my sock. And so this is another element of the sensitivity that the parent needs to demonstrate towards the child in so far as understanding how much challenge does this child need, how much can they take.
Yeah, and if a child's becoming incredibly overwhelmed and tearful, that's obviously not fun, is it?
That's right, and that's no longer rough and tumble play. It's developing into something else and it needs to change, finish.
And tell us a little bit, you've mentioned Italian children that you've done some work with. What about cultural differences, Peter? What would you say? And are there particular cultures where rough and tumble play is more widely enjoyed and appreciated?
It seems to be observed in every culture, you know, that people have studied, whether it's psychologists or anthropologists, from hunter-gatherers and agricultural societies through to urban societies such as ours. But of course, the context changes. For example, hunter-gatherer groups, there are not many left now, but there are some groups of people like the Bush people in South Africa and so on, still living by hunting and gathering. They tend to live in small groups. There's plenty of rough and tumble play going on amongst the children groups. The interesting thing is they're relatively small groups of children of different ages and genders, unlike a school situation where you have children of the same age basically out in the playground. So you get much more mixed age and mixed gender play going on. And those gender differences I talked about earlier are not so obvious. Girls are doing quite a lot of this play fighting as well as the boys in that situation, and there's cross age. It struck me, actually, Jennifer, there's an interesting difference, isn't there, in the family situation and the school situation. The family situation, you're going to have siblings usually of different ages, whereas in the school situation, pretty much you're with your peers in the same class and the same age. So the strength differences are not so obvious. But I guess in the sibling situation, unless they're twins, you know, or close in age, the parent has to kind of watch out, don't they, that one child doesn't dominate. But anyway, that doesn't seem to happen too much in the hunter-gatherer groups. And as I've said, other societies, there's plenty going on as well. How much rough and tumble play there is in peer groups, it depends. I mean, if you're in a tarmac playground, it's not very safe wrestling and tumbling and falling around. But if you're on a grassy surface, it's much safer. There's more rough and tumble play going on, say, in grassy surfaces, you know, than on tarmac playgrounds. Things like this, which are rather obvious, but they can affect the frequency of rough and tumble play too.
And of course, you've mentioned the boundary between this type of play slipping into bullying, even between sibling bullying is relatively common. And I know you know so much about that particular topic, Peter. So tell us a little bit about, it's the power differential, isn't it, between the two players, if you like, and also the tone of it.
Yeah. Well, bullying is normally defined as aggressive behavior where there's an imbalance of power. so it's not easy to defend yourself. So it's a more limited concept than just fighting. It's fighting with an unequal component built into it. As far as rough and tumble play goes, it doesn't look like it changes into aggression or bullying very frequently until you get to adolescence. And I did mention that earlier. When you get to adolescence, it's as if some children might take advantage of the rough and tumble convention, the sort of understanding, you know, you can hit someone in rough and tumble play and it's okay. They take advantage of that to actually hit rather hard, or show that, or not do the role reverse, or just stay on top, show they're stronger. They can sort of display their strength against a weaker opponent, pretending it's playful, even when it, in fact it might not be playful, it might be verging into bully aggression and bullying. So that can happen. I'm not saying it's very frequent, but it can happen, especially with some children who want to display their power in this way.
And what do we know about girls and play fighting? You've mentioned that they do enjoy and partake in this activity. Is it just a sort of a stereotype that they wouldn't be as interested, Jennifer?
That's been our experience in our studies to date, really, is that girls quite often, almost as often as boys, and particularly in the later studies that have happened in the sort of the 20s, that show that the girls are just as keen to play. And you could say at times, depending on what cohort you're looking at, that sometimes the girls' play does look slightly different, like I talked before about gentle and tumble. And we've also noted in a way that girls are more prone or more quickly come to higher emotions in terms of screaming or crying in this high emotive responses to the play more quickly. And the other aspect of it, of course, is that fathers tend to be more involved in the play than the mums, and they tend to do it more with their sons than with their daughters.
Yeah, in animal species, there's a gender difference I mentioned. It's mainly the males doing the play fighting. So I suspect there is a real gender difference in humans, but I suspect also, as perhaps Jennifer was suggesting, that might be exaggerated by the stereotypes we have. So what differences that there might be tend to be exaggerated. You know, the parents and teachers may think it's more natural for boys to do this than girls.
We've had lots of head teachers write to us about this topic when they knew we were doing this podcast. So let's just focus a little bit on teacher view of play fighting. Some teachers have asked if you would both consider it optimal to have an area of the playground allowed for play fighting where there are boundaries and rules that are actually set out on that chalkboard saying, you know, this is where you can play, but these are the rules. Or should we not interfere with the kind of the natural evolution of that play in the playground? And also, how can educators navigate parental views of what looks like quite rough play when actually they know it's developmentally optimal for children? So if you were head teachers, what would you be doing in those circumstances? Jennifer?
Okay, we'll start. So I think what is important, thinking about those rules and thinking about the space. So the space is definitely the dedicated space that needs to be there, needs to be safe and appropriate for falling around, as Peter mentioned before. So you want grassy spaces, you need enough room, you don't want corners, you don't want furniture, you don't want items of, you know, swings and those sorts of things. And Peter will talk more about that, but I think the idea of a chalkboard with rules is one thing. I think an adult with experience of the difference between aggression and play fighting as a moderator or as a monitor in the space may be very useful as a way of teaching children about rules. Because as we all know, there'll probably be children who come into that space who might be interested and invited into the play, but not have experience of it themselves. And so, or perhaps even negative experiences of that. And so they may be prone to, at first, play in non-playful ways, and it's their peers and possibly their teachers that are going to be able to help regulate them play from externally at first, you know.
Yeah, I'd be, rather than saying, here's a space you can do rough and tumble, I'd rather be more laid back about it and, you know, let children choose what they want to do, but have an area where there's a quiet area, like we mentioned earlier. So if some children in playtime just want to sit quietly and chat or play a sedentary game or something, that's fine. There's an area where they can do that and you wouldn't have other children running around and play fighting and so on. The other aspect, I think, would be the lunchtime supervisors. I'm thinking now of the sort of fairly longer breaks we have in schools in England, perhaps for 40 minutes at lunchtime. And teachers don't supervise that in England. It's what we call lunchtime supervisors, who are normally parents, actually, from the local community or people from the local community who don't get much training for it. They're just paid a small amount to be around in the playground and make sure, you know, things are okay. Now, they're adults. Some of them, like some parents, may not be too clear about the distinction between play fighting and real fighting. And it's important that they are clear, because they shouldn't be stopping play fighting. The children will tell them, look, we're only playing this, you know. The trouble is, we're only playing this might be true, or it might be the excuse for the bullying child we talked about earlier, you know. So you need to be aware of the signs that we talked about. Who's enjoying this activity? Are other children watching? Is the role reversal going on? These sorts of things. So in a way, lunchtime supervisors need to be trained a bit about what rough and tumble play in peers looks like. And there are some courses or videos actually that do this, which seem to be quite helpful.
And also, I think knowing the children, if you don't know the children very well, you can't distinguish between that, you know, what that the quality of that relationship and if there is a power differential. So those are really important roles within that playground setting. One of the things head teachers have noticed is that only children tend to be a little bit more alarmed, particularly post-pandemic, by this type of play in the playground. Is there any research that you're aware of about only children and their reaction to that type of play?
I don't know of any, actually. Jennifer, do you know anything on?
No, I'm not specifically focusing, comparing only to children with siblings.
What about how many siblings there are in the family? Does that make an influence?
That's not something that we've experimented with as in our observational studies. But I think you probably can just lend back to the fact of role modelling and teaching and experience there in terms of what have the children learnt in their homes? Have they had parents that have been involved in that sort of physical play? And perhaps they haven't. And so that can make a difference, of course, to how the child responds to play invitations in the playground.
Okay, so one last question for you is about training. You've just mentioned useful videos. I know teachers will be saying, where's the training, Peter? Do you do training? How do we get our playground assistants trained? What is available that you're aware of that even both of you could contribute?
Well, I know a colleague in England, it's Dr. Michael Bolton, actually. He devised a video training. He would be the I can send you the details to contact him if you wish. I can't give it right now, but I can send it to you.
Perfect, perfect. And do you have, I know both of you are academics, but is there a particular resource or useful information leaflet that you think every playground, you know, staff member should use and read or something accessible, Jennifer?
So, Kathy, a while back now, an author in America wrote a beautiful book about rough and tumble play. I can't think of the title right now, but Anthony de Benedette. And it's all about the sorts of games that children play and with very clear descriptions of what the sort of play is about and why it's useful. And it's written really from almost a parent's point of view. And so that is a very approachable entree, if you like, into the rough and tumble space. Certainly the research shows, and there's been a lot of research really one way or another on school teachers and their attitudes to rough and tumble play. And mainly the research shows that as soon as teachers have some education about that and some familiarisation with it, then their attitudes change.
That's right. And that's so exciting. I mean, it's such an important area. Sorry, Peter, you were going to say something there.
No, I was just agreeing with what Jennifer said. There's quite a bit of evidence that teachers' views can change when they learn more about what rough and tumble play is.
Well, hopefully this podcast and initiate that sort of dialogue within schools, because traditionally early years teachers are much more familiar with this type of play, but not potentially in primary and sort of prep schools and beyond.
Yes, and it probably accompanies the more recent development of understanding risk in playgrounds better. So there's been a lot of research, hasn't there, lately or in the last 10 to 15 years on how to deal with risk, and that includes physical risk as well as emotional risk. And I remember Ellen Sansage has done some wonderful research in that space, and the title she used in her thesis and in some of her research papers is this feeling in their tummies of scary funny. And so that's a really great way of encapsulating the experience of rough and tumble play. It's slightly scary because, is this big person going to beat me? But it's also fun and enjoyable because I'm challenging someone. I'm also interacting with someone I love. And so they're making my life a bit more enjoyable, and I'm sort of contributing to them as well. So I think it's a good conversation to have in the school policy department and in the school amongst the school teachers, just to understand what the signs are. And there's plenty of research out there now that really articulates those differences between play fighting and aggression.
And I know there's research by a lady called Rachel Nesbitt on the power of adventurous play in school settings, where it's quite recent research looking at, you know, the impact on problem solving, emotional regulation, and also the transferability into the classroom in terms of readiness for learning. So it's a rich area. And what are you both working on now that we'd love to tell our schools about, Peter?
Well, my research at the moment is mainly on the school bullying that you mentioned earlier, actually, and looking at ways to help schools combat bullying. There's quite a bit of work going on there, and it's having mixed success, I would say. There are some difficulties. Interventions do usually reduce bullying, but they don't eliminate it. So there's a sort of, if you like, a hard core of children who seem to be involved either as perpetrators or targets, that it can be difficult to change their behaviour. So that's quite a big challenge, I think, for those of us working in that area.
Okay, thank you. Jennifer?
Yes, so my area, when I look at rough and tumble play, I'm really particularly interested in the parent-child relationship and particularly the father-child relationship. So, for example, I've done work with Daniel Paquette where we've looked at how can we explain rough and tumble play in terms of the relationship. And so your listeners might be familiar with the attachment relationship between parent and child, and that's about keeping the child safe and providing that safe haven. And Daniel's work has expanded the idea of the relationship quality to include what he calls the activation relationship. And so this is the relationship where the child is seeking to learn more about the world and explore the world, and a parent who supports that is developing the activation relationship with the child. So my interest is in that space. And so the work we're doing at the moment is looking at just how does a father's interactions with the child through rough and tumble activate the brain regions, and how do these brain regions then translate into, in the father, into parenting behaviors, and in the child into self-regulatory types of behaviors.
Well, at the time of recording this, it's Men's Mental Health Week next week. And I think probably, we don't have time to go into it, but it probably has a beneficial impact on those fathers in terms of their own well-being.
I remember as a father rough and tumbling with my children when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. And it was great fun, you know, and we would chase each other and tickle each other and grapple. And they knew it was fun, and I respected their boundaries. And of course, they're learning those things that Jennifer mentioned. They're learning their emotional control as well. But there's this bonding function too. And in the peer-peer relationship, it's very much friends who are typically play fighting with each other and enjoying it.
But equally, we're the only people in the world as adults who can really engage with our children with that level of physicality. So it's a very precious type of play, Jennifer, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And look, there's so much research on infants and infant development that talks about the importance of touch. And we, when we're writing the theoretical beginnings of our papers, we often refer to those sorts of theories and that type of research to better understand or explain why rough and tumble could be such a powerful influence on the relationship and the development of the child, because physical touch is so important to development. So, and as Peter says, what it also does is it contributes to the strength of the relationships between people.
There's a lovely professor here, Professor Charles Desforges, and he says it doesn't matter how rich or poor we are, it's what we do with our children that matters. And that just reminds me, you know, of this is an exciting interview because it's inspiring. It's going to inspire us as parents, as teachers. We've got lots to think about. And just to finish, thank you so much for your extensive contributions, you know, to this research and for all that you're doing in your respective areas to support children's development and to support us as families. So thank you so much for contributing today, both of you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up